堂听 class.com。
第四十二单元，国际社会。
Unit 42, the International Community.
篇章交传。
Passage for consecutive interpretation. Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese.
Distinguished delegates, colleagues, friends, ladies and gentlemen, the arrival of the new millennium is an occasion for celebration and reflection. In this new era, globalization is transforming the world, and people's actions constantly, if often unwittingly,affect the lives of others living far away. Globalization offers great opportunities, but at present, its benefits are very unevenly distributed, while its costs are borne by all. Thus, the central challenge we face today is to ensure that globalization becomes a positive force for all the world's people, instead of leaving billions of them behind in squalor.Inclusive globalization must be built on the great enabling force of the market. But market forces alone will not achieve it. It requires a broader effort to create a shared future, based upon our common humanity in all its diversity. That in turn requires that we think afresh about how we manage our joint activities and our shared interests. For many challenges that we confront todayare beyond the reach of any state to meet on its own. At the national level, we must govern better, and at the international level, we must learn to govern better together. Effective states are essential for both tasks, and their capacity for both needs strengthening. We must also adapt international institutions, through which states govern together, to the realities of the new era.We must form coalitions for change, often with partners well beyond the precinct of officialdom. No shift in the way we think or act can be more critical than this. We must put people at the center of everything we do. No calling is more noble, and no responsibility greater than that of enabling men, women, and children in cities and villages around the world to make their lives better.Only when that begins to happen will we know that globalization is indeed becoming inclusive, allowing everyone to share its opportunities. We must do more than talk about our future, however. We must start to create it now. The United Nations alone can meet none of the challenges I have described. They affect the entire international community, and they require all of us to do our part.But without a strong and effective organization, the peoples of the world will find meeting these challenges immeasurably more difficult. Whether the world's peoples have such an organization at their disposal depends ultimately, now as in the past, on the commitment of their governments to it. Now, as then, the member states are the very foundation of the United Nations.Today, we must reaffirm our founding purposes, but we must also think imaginatively how to strengthen the United Nations so that it can better serve states and people alike in the new era. Today, global affairs are no longer the exclusive province of foreign ministries, nor are states the sole source of solutions for our small planet's many problems.Many diverse and increasingly influential non-state actors have joined with national decision-makers to improve new forms of global governance. The more complex the problem at hand, whether negotiating a ban on landmines, setting limits to emissions that contribute to global warming, or creating an international criminal court, the more likely we are to find non-governmental organizations,private sector institutions, and multilateral agencies working with sovereign states to find consensus solutions. I believe two strategies will be essential to realize the potential of our organization in the years ahead. First, while our own resources as an organization are tightly constrained, those of the communities we serve are much greater. We must strive not to usurp the role of other actors on the world stage, but to become a more effective catalyst for change and coordination among them. Our most vital role will be to stimulate collective action at the global level. Second, the United Nations, like all other institutions in the world today, must fully exploit the great promise of the information age. The digital revolution has unleashed an unprecedented wave of technological change. Used responsibly, it can greatly improve our chances of defeating poverty and better meeting our other priority objectives. If this is to happen, we in the United Nations need to embrace the new technologies more wholeheartedly than we have in the past. The United Nations can succeed in helping to meet those challenges only if all of us feel a renewed sense of mission about our common endeavor, and the world's people are looking to their leaders to act on the major challenges ahead.
第43单元，维和使命。
Unit 43, The Mission of Peacekeeping.
篇章交传。
Passage for consecutive interpretation.
Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese.
Preserving world peace is a central purpose of the United Nations. Under the Charter, member states agree to settle disputes by peaceful means and refrain from threatening or using force against other states. Over the years,The UN has played a major role in helping diffuse international crises and in resolving protracted conflicts. It has undertaken complex operations involving peacemaking, peacekeeping, and humanitarian assistance. It has worked to prevent conflicts from breaking out, and after a conflict, it has increasingly undertaken action to address the root causes of war and lay the foundation for durable peace.UN efforts have produced dramatic results. The UN helped defuse the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962 and the Middle East Crisis in 1973. In 1988, a UN-sponsored peace settlement ended the Iran-Iraq War, and the following year, UN-sponsored negotiations led to the withdrawal of Soviet troops from Afghanistan. In the 1990s,The UN was instrumental in restoring sovereignty to Kuwait and played a major role in ending civil wars in Cambodia, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Mozambique, restoring the democratically elected government in Haiti, and resolving or containing conflict in various other countries. Halting the spread of arms and reducing and eventually eliminating all weapons of mass destruction are major goals of the United Nations.The UN has been an ongoing forum for disarmament negotiations, making recommendations and initiating studies. It supports multilateral negotiations in the Conference on Disarmament and in other international bodies. These negotiations have produced such agreements as the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, 1968, the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, 1996,and treaties for establishing nuclear-free zones. Other treaties prohibit the development, production, and stockpiling of chemical weapons, 1992, and bacteriological weapons, 1972. Ban nuclear weapons from the seabed and ocean floor, 1971, and outer space, 1967. And ban or restrict other types of weapons.By 2001, more than 120 countries had become parties to the 1997 Ottawa Convention outlawing landmines. The UN encourages all nations to adhere to this and other treaties banning destructive weapons of war. The UN is also supporting efforts to prevent, combat, and eradicate the illicit trade in small arms and light weapons, the weapons of choice in 46 of 49 major conflicts since 1990. The UN Register of Conventional Arms and the System for Standardized Reporting of Military Expenditures help promote greater transparency in military matters. UN peacemaking brings hostile parties to agreement through diplomatic means. The Security Council, in its efforts to maintain international peace and security, may recommend ways to avoid conflict or restore or secure peace. The Secretary General plays an important role in peacemaking. The Secretary General may bring to the attention of the Security Council any matter that appears to threaten international peace and security, use good offices to carry out mediation or exercise quiet diplomacy behind the scenes, either personally or through special envoys. The Secretary General also undertakes preventive diplomacy aimed at resolving disputes before they escalate. The UN is increasingly undertaking activities that address the underlying causes of conflict. Development assistance is a key element of peace building. In cooperation with UN agencies, donor countries, host governments, and NGOs, the United Nations works to help war-torn countries rebuild administrative, health, educational, and other services disrupted by war. Some of these activities, such as the UN supervision of the 1989 elections in Namibia, mine clearance programs in Mozambique, and police training in Haiti, take place within the framework of a UN peacekeeping operation and may continue when the operation withdraws. Others are requested by governments, as in Cambodia, where the UN maintains a human rights office, or in Guatemala, where the UN is helping to implement peace agreements which affect virtually all aspects of national life. The Security Council sets up UN peacekeeping operations and defines their scope and mandate in its efforts to maintain peace and international security. Most operations involve military duties, such as observing a ceasefire or establishing a buffer zone while negotiators seek a long-term solution. Others may require civilian police or other civilian personnel to help organize elections or monitor human rights. Operations have also been deployed to monitor peace agreements in cooperation with the peacekeeping forces of regional organizations. Peacekeeping operations may last for a few months or continue for many years. The UN's operation at the ceasefire line between India and Pakistan in the state of Jammu and Kashmir, for example, was established in 1949, and UN peacekeepers have been in Cyprus since 1964. In contrast, the UN was able to complete its 1994 mission in the Azov Strait between Libya and Chad in a little over a month. Since the UN first deployed peacekeepers in 1948, some 123 countries have voluntarily provided more than 750,000 military and civilian police personnel. They have served, along with thousands of civilians, in 54 peacekeeping operations.
第44单元, 联合国序.
Unit 44, About the United Nations.
篇章交传.
Passage for consecutive interpretation. Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese.
The United Nations has six main organs. Five of them, the General Assembly, the Security Council, the Economic and Social Council, the Trusteeship Council, and the Secretariat, are based at UN headquarters in New York. The sixth, the International Court of Justice, is located at The Hague in the Netherlands. 1. The General Assembly. All UN member states are represented in the General Assembly, a parliament of nations which meets to consider the world's most pressing problems. Each member state has one vote. Decisions on such key issues as international peace and security, admitting new members, and the UN budget are decided by two-thirds majority. Other matters are decided by simple majority. In recent years, a special effort has been made to reach decisions through consensus, rather than by taking a formal vote. The Assembly holds its annual regular session from September to December. When necessary, it may resume its session or hold a special or emergency session on subjects of particular concern. When the Assembly is not meeting, its work is carried out by its six main committees, other subsidiary bodies, and the UN Secretariat. 2. The Security Council. The UN Charter gives the Security Council primary responsibility for maintaining international peace and security. The Council may convene at any time whenever peace is threatened. Under the Charter, all member states are obligated to carry out the Council's decisions. There are 15 Council members. Five of these, China, France, the Russian Federation, the United Kingdom, and the United States, are permanent members. The other 10 are elected by the General Assembly for 2-year terms. Member states discuss things like making changes in Council membership and working to reflect today's political and economic realities. Decisions of the Council require 9 yes votes. Except in votes on procedural questions, a decision cannot be taken if there is a no vote or veto by a permanent member. When the Council considers a threat to international peace, it first explores ways to settle the dispute peacefully. It may suggest principles for a settlement or undertake mediation. In the event of fighting, the Council tries to secure a ceasefire. It may send a peacekeeping mission to help the parties maintain the truce and to keep opposing forces apart. 3. The Economic and Social Council. The Economic and Social Council, under the overall authority of the General Assembly, coordinates the economic and social work of the United Nations and the UN family of organizations. As the central forum for discussing international economic and social issues and for formulating policy recommendations, the Council plays a key role in fostering international cooperation for development. It also consults with non-governmental organizations, NGOs, thereby maintaining a vital link between the United Nations and civil society. The Council has 54 members, elected by the General Assembly for 3-year terms. It meets throughout the year and holds a major session in July, during which a special meeting of ministers discusses major economic, social, and humanitarian issues. 4. The Trusteeship Council. The Trusteeship Council was established to provide international supervision for 11 trust territories administered by 7 member states and ensure that adequate steps were taken to prepare the territories for self-government or independence. By 1994, all trust territories had attained self-government or independence, either as separate states or by joining neighboring independent countries. The last to do so was the Trust Territory of the Pacific Islands, Palau, which was administered by the United States and became the 185th member state. Its work completed, the Trusteeship Council now consists of the 5 permanent members of the Security Council. It has amended its rules of procedure to allow it to meet as and when the occasion may require. 5. The International Court of Justice. The International Court of Justice, also known as the World Court, is the main judicial organ of the UN. Consisting of 15 judges elected jointly by the General Assembly and the Security Council, the Court decides disputes between countries. Participation by states in a proceeding is voluntary, but if a state agrees to participate, it is obligated to comply with the Court's decision. The Court also provides advisory opinions to the General Assembly and the Security Council upon request. 6. The Secretariat. The Secretariat carries out the substantive and administrative work of the United Nations, as directed by the General Assembly, the Security Council, and the other organs. At its head is the Security General, who provides overall administrative guidance. The Secretariat consists of departments and offices with a total staff of some 7,500 under the regular budget and a nearly equal number under special funding. They are drawn from some 170 countries. Duty stations include UN headquarters in New York, as well as UN offices in Geneva, Vienna, Nairobi, and other locations.
第45单元，全球合作。
Unit 45, Global Cooperation.
篇章交传。
Passage for consecutive interpretation.
Listen to the tape and interpret the following passage from English into Chinese.
Mr. President, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen,It is a privilege to participate in this important conference today. This conference takes place against the background of a significant strengthening of the global economic outlook. Led by the United States, the world economy now has the potential for a return to solid growth. The recovery is broadening and deepening, with all major regions showing improvement. And Asia, led by China and India, is in the vanguard of the global recovery.This rising tide will also lift our country, and we expect growth in this country to accelerate in the coming year. But we know that there are still risks to this outlook, notably arising from the persistent current account imbalances in the global economy. The recovery is still uneven, with growth relatively rapid in the United States and emerging Asia, picking up in Japan, but with the euro area lagging behind.Ensuring that the recovery is robust and sustained requires cooperation, and such cooperation should ensure that no region bears a disproportionate burden of adjustment. This requires a durable increase in national savings in the United States, with priority on establishing a framework for returning to fiscal balance over the medium term. It requires an ambitious acceleration of the pace of structural reform in Europe and Japan to lift their productive potential. And in those countries in Asia that have experienced a rapid accumulation of foreign exchange reserves, it requires making increased use of the scope for exchange rate flexibility and structural reforms to underpin domestic demand growth. Such commitments,made more credible by being collective, would underpin the expectation of a smooth adjustment in global imbalances. Asia's growing weight in the world economy gives it an important role in global cooperation. Asia now accounts for over a quarter of world exports and one-third of world output. My country itself surely ranks among the leading examples of Asia's success.Our real per capita income has increased eightfold over the past two generations, and Asia is rapidly becoming more integrated. Intra-regional trade now accounts for 40% of Asia's exports, compared to 30% a decade ago. China's strong growth in particular is fueling a vibrant Northeast Asian region.Embracing global economic integration lies at the root of Asia's success, and globalization continues to offer much promise for Asia and for the world. I see tremendous potential for further long-term growth in the global economy. Technological progress continues at a rapid pace, and ever stronger trade and financial linkages are promoting further international division of labor and expanding markets.Holding out the promise of gains in productivity and standards of living everywhere. But these gains are not automatic. Many have not been able to seize the opportunities offered by globalization, and severe poverty persists in too many countries. As we know from experience, Openness and economic interdependence can exacerbate the spillovers of economic shocks across countries and amplify domestic economic problems. Moreover, the rapid integration of China, India, and other large emerging markets into the world economy is raising competitive pressures for everyone, increasing the need for flexibility and innovation. How can other countries in Asia best address these pressures? And how can all countries ensure that they can seize benefits and opportunities of globalization while containing its inevitable risks? First, domestic economic policies in Asia must continue to be geared toward building resilient and competitive economies. This requires, in particular, strengthening domestic sources of growth, including vigorously tackling incomplete reforms in the financial and corporate sectors. It also requires pursuing policies that make economies more flexible and capable of absorbing economic shocks more easily. And it requires maintaining a good business climate, conducive to investment, growth, and employment creation. Second, regional cooperation in Asia must complement national policies. Growing regional and global interdependence requires that policymakers pay increasing attention to the international context of their decisions. Asia is going in the right direction. East Asian countries will surely play an increasingly important role in promoting regional integration. A regional focus that remains open to the rest of the world holds the greatest promise for Asia's long-term growth prospects. Third, effective multilateral cooperation is essential for a successful globalization, and trade liberalization is a key pillar of this cooperation. It is well worth reminding ourselves that the tremendous expansion in global prosperity was only possible in the context of broad-based multilateral trade liberalization within a framework of reciprocity and rules. Ladies and gentlemen, Asia's success story was once dubbed the Asian miracle. But I would not call it a miracle. Rather, it was the result of hard work, economic policies that encouraged business investment, and, not least, a strategy to participate and compete in the world economy. I agree that Northeast Asia, which used to be on the periphery of the modern world, is now emerging as a source of energy in the global economy. And I am confident that a vibrant Northeast Asia region will also benefit all world citizens and make a significant contribution to the world in the process of globalization. Thank you very much.